This is Mark Morris, host of Architecture on Air, a podcast interview series organized by the College of Architecture at UNC Charlotte. The impetus for this series came from requests from students admitting that while they were confident in their design work visually, they felt awkward or ill-prepared to talk about their work. They lacked a clear language of architecture, a way of communicating their thoughts and intentions to an audience outside their immediate architecture school peer group. This series means to respond to that request by interviewing practitioners, academics, and critics that have some reputation for being particularly adept at using words to describe the built environment and architectural concepts to a broad audience. For this installment in the series, I visit Stephen Connor, professor of modern literature and theory at Birkbeck College at the University of London, where he heads the London Consortium. Steve is also a regular contributor to BBC Radio. His voice is well known. Indeed, Professor Connor has the unique distinction of being his college's official orator. This is someone who cares deeply about language, someone who cannot stop himself teasing out the full descriptive measure of words. He even creates words where needed, architectural terms like spatiopedal and spatiofugal, which feature in the broadcast. Our discussion is wide-ranging, dealing with notions of air versus space, the evaporation of form in favor of mobility, and interdisciplinary trends in architecture, something many students are interested in at the moment. Steve assumes a broad-based cultural literacy, referencing philosophers like Heidegger and Bachelard, feminist theorist Irigaray, authors Dickens and E.M. Forster, and the poet Thomas Hardy. We meet in his darkly paneled office near Senate House Library. He is not academically tweedy. He does not hold a pipe or wear a beard. He is a contemporary figure, fit and trim, dressed simply, and immersed in the world as it is or is about to be. Connor is never at a loss for words. Words are his currency. This trait is essential here as we treat fairly elusive aspects of architecture. So many castles in the air. With me today is Stephen Connor, professor of modern literature and theory, director of the London Consortium, author of several books, including The Book of Skin and Dumbstruck, The Cultural History of Ventriloquism, and the upcoming title, Fly. To my mind, you are one of the leading figures supporting the cause of interdisciplinary scholarship, in the broadest and most serious sense of the term. Your work and your professional stance have increasingly operated under the banner of interdisciplinarity. But could it also be said that given your work cuts across several disciplines and schools, that you are in fact transdisciplinary? Do you know the difference, Steve, or do these labels mean very much to you?
Well, it's very important to me, I suppose, that the work that I find that I'm able to do, I'm interested in doing, I'm permitted to do, and that people sometimes seem to want to read, that this work seems not just to be what it is, but also to be in some way productive or predictive, that people think, oh, I could do something like that somewhere else, so that it seems to, you know, to point somewhere else as well as to be something that is worthwhile. So, you know, to that degree, I like the sense, perhaps this is work that is on its way somewhere, it's in transition. So to that degree, if to be transdisciplinary is to signal something a little bit more mobile than being interdisciplinary, which perhaps suggests maybe, you know, the overlapping of circles, some more stationary intersection between established and immobile fields of inquiry. Well, that would be good. It has interesting corollaries. One might be that to be transdisciplinary might mean that you would actually end up somewhere else than where you started. And the funny thing is, my notion of what it means to do interdisciplinary work has to have that built into it. You see, because what I think is, or at least my experience has been, that there isn't a way of naturally or comfortably or even kind of knowledgeably inhabiting interdisciplinarity. You actually don't know what it is and what the space consists of, because I think the specific nature of the interdisciplinarity will be different depending on what the problem is, what the issue is, what the thing is that's preoccupying you.
Well, one of the languages you speak is indeed architecture, and I wondered if we could focus on your voice in the architectural world today, a voice that is taken seriously both academically and in popular media. You've been invited to give several lectures to architecture schools and have offered a series of architectural talks on radio. How did you, or when did you notice your work drifting, if not transgressing, into architecture? Were you always interested in the built environment, or were you turned on to architecture through a topic or specific people or even a specific building?
There have certainly been architectural themes and things I've been drawn to, though I've only come to recognize them as such, I think, since I started knocking around with architects. And that has been really for the last 10 years that I've been involved with the London Consortium, which is a collaboration that we run in London between my college, Birkbeck College, the Institute of Contemporary Arts, Tate, and the Architectural Association. So I've encountered a lot of these creatures, architects, I mean. The interesting thing to me, just speaking institutionally for a moment, is that architecture is one of those disciplines that actually includes pretty much everything. And it seemed to me that the last 10, 20 years have been periods in which architects themselves have suddenly realized this, that all the stuff other people seem to be talking about actually is part of their territory. And this is true of a lot of other subjects like geography. Right. You know, pretty much everything happens in Earth, on Earth or in the universe.
Well, more and more.
You know, so it's all geography. Or philosophers think the same, and so do theologians. And so do people in English literature departments, as it happens, rather more bizarrely. So you know, it seems to me that architecture has good warrant for... you know, for feeling as though it is implicated in lots of things. And so I, in a sense then, I wasn't surprised to find that there had been architectural themes or strands or resonances in things that I'd done. I wrote an early essay about Dickens's architect. There's an architect in Martin Chuzzlewit, Mr. Podsnap.
Oh.
And so I wrote an essay about Dickens's architecture, in that, and it was actually interesting because it seemed to me that in that novel Dickens wasn't tremendously knowledgeable about architecture, but he was very interested in built and designed spaces. He had a particular fondness for snug spaces, the interiors of ships and cabins and very tight little kind of garrets, and he was also interested in urban untidiness and the logics and perplexities of untidy spaces. It was interesting to have that, you know, kind of set in architectural terms in Martin Chuzzlewit. So there was a kind of awareness of that some way back. But more importantly, what, just thinking about this question in response to what you've said, what I think I've always been interested in is a kind of evacuated or spectral architecture. I'll say what I mean by that with reference to a poem I've always loved by Thomas Hardy, which is called During Wind and Rain, which gives you a series of vignettes of a single family over the period of a lifetime, several lifetimes actually. And one of these vignettes is the family is moving house, and the stanza goes, they move to a high new house, he, she, all of them, yea, clocks and carpets and chairs on the lawn all day, and precious things that are theirs. And I found this image just haunting of a house emptied out and the clocks and the carpets and chairs on the lawn all day. The sense of strangeness, dislocation and abandonment that's embodied in that image, you know, I realise now kind of haunted me for years. And so it's that kind of sense of architecture, the sense of the the building of places and spaces, sometimes through forms of dislocation, forms of, well, the making of lived-in spaces was, I think, what interested me. And of course, there were plenty of ways in which someone writing about literature would be able to be responsive to that without recognizing it, without thinking of it as the kind of thing that architects might become interested in.
But that moment in the poem, the kind of move, which is always kind of fraught every time one moves house, you notice how delicate your belongings are when they're kind of chucked into the van. But that's kind of the inverse, isn't it, to that notion of snugness from Dickens. That, in fact, in England, you have rooms called snugs, right?
Yes, yes.
Something like a den, I guess. Some place with a.
Well, it names a room in a pub where women could go and drink without being seen or being acknowledged, actually. In northern pubs, they're still sometimes called a snug. But there is also a snuggery, which means a little den or a burrow, you know.
You take the marriage of architecture and air as a critical site, as a proper space for intellectual work. Could you describe that critical site, what it covers and why it has been meaningful for you to dwell there? In a sense, you've kind of given us the history why you came to that topic. Is it part of your future as well? Do you think you'll continue to visit this architectural realm as part of your kind of larger work, whether it's interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary?
Yes. Well, the first thing to be said is that it strikes me that architecture itself is in an extraordinary period, a period in which it's taking stock of the fact that the sorts of things that information architects talk about, which is to say simply the ways in which things are hooked up rather than the ways in which necessarily they're disposed in space, that increasingly is becoming a central mainstream concern of architecture. So it's important, I think, to recognise that, at least as far as I can see it being something of an outsider, that architecture is dematerialising, de-territorialising, at a rather frantic pace, it seems to me. As a matter of fact, it's rather alarming to people who have kind of rather more traditional expectations of architects and their interests to find that, you know, scarcely any architects seem to be interested in buildings that stay in one place.
Right.
You know. Anyway, but so architecture is kind of on the move, and I'm on the move in that I have been interested for a long time in ways of writing about intangible things. Somebody said to me, they'd been to my website, and they said, you only seem to be interested in invisible things, Steve.
That's right.
And I suppose it is true. I have a lot of interest in sound, and I became interested in air, in writing about trying to find some way of writing intelligibly about human imagination of the air and sort of actual and imaginary inhabitation of the air quite a long time ago, and have been sort of, you know, coming at it from different points of view and trying to shape the topic for a long time. And that's really rather like, you know, working with air. It's like literally trying to kind of knit mist into some kind of shape. And I really still don't have any idea what kind of shape it would have. So in a certain sense, you know, air is the opposite of architecture. And yet, there is this immense and venerable tradition of building or imagining buildings in air, or imagining buildings that have some significantly enclosing relationship to air, for example, through sound. And we have this expression, building castles in the air, which means building castles on something that won't sustain them, that can't really exist. And yet the phrase, which when you say it is literally made of air, makes it exist. So that's the ambivalence of the air, and it's an ambivalence in which many architects, perhaps most architects, occupy most of the time, that's to say, working with invisible, non-existent buildings.
Well, you'll talk to architects about those kind of imaginary spaces, but then you talk about space itself. And space, architects feel, is their domain, that they can kind of shape and form and close and envelope it. But air doesn't really enter into an architect's typical notion of space. I mean, you tried to address this a bit in a recent talk at the Bartlett School of Architecture, a talk titled Building Breathing Space, where you gave a very clear description of architecture and its relationship to air, including specific typologies of architecture. We might note that a lot of this has to do with sound as well, places like the theater. You mentioned specific infrastructural components of architecture, including the chimney and the flue, specific building systems, if we think of permeable skins and new interest in building envelope technology. Not to mention offering a reinterpretation of the architecture as body metaphor, paying particular attention to breathing and smelling. I mean, you talk about these things, noting Heidegger and others, trying to question or come back to the question of the body in architecture, which I think is a topic of interest to students currently. How is the conception of dwelling, both for the verb and noun, linked to air for you? How does building breathing space relate to anything like this notion of castles in the air?
I had, when I was trying to bring together architecture and air and think about their relations, I found it useful to work in the vicinity of Heidegger's well-known essay, Building, Dwelling, Thinking, partly because that essay had itself been the subject of a critique by Luce Irigaray called The Forgetting of Air in Martin Heidegger, in which he said, look, Heidegger focuses on the analogies between thinking, building, and dwelling, you know, being with 2 feet on the ground, fundamentally. And what this forgets is that human beings don't live on Earth, they live on Earth and in the air that is part of Earth. And for Irigaray, the air is abundance, it's infinitude, it's that which goes beyond, that which cannot be enclosed. And for her, Heidegger signifies a male metaphysics, which always wants to enclose, to make things, to ground things, to make them hard. And although Heidegger claims to, you know, to be opposed to the metaphysical tradition of the West, in fact, he's reinstating it. Lots of things to be said about this. First of all, this word dwelling. Now, dwelling is a funny word because it's a bit like vowing and slaying, you know. The only people who vow and slay are medieval knights and people in the tabloid newspapers. No one ever uses those words, and no one would ever say, you'd never hear anyone saying to each other, where do you dwell? Mm. You know, though you might hear of people dwelling on things. And dwelling is very sort of elvish or hobbity sort of mode of right. relating to things. And it's the notion of the chthonic, of something that is, as it were, that lives in the place that it's somehow made of, as though, you know, like the beginning of E.M. Forster's Passage to India. The town seemed made of mud, the inhabitants of mud moving. But the word dwell has a very interesting origin. It comes from a series of old Norse words whose root meaning is to stun, dumbfound, bewilder, perplex. The idea being that you cause people to come to a halt in perplexity. That's what to dwell originally means. So then the meaning gets transferred, so that to dwell somewhere means to abide somewhere, but not comfortably. So I think there's something very interesting about this sense of the fact that dwelling, the word dwelling, has only very slowly and historically come to kind of settle down. Originally it meant a kind of a, you know, I'm in one place because I'm at a loss. I'm kind of stuck. I've been deflected from my purpose. Human beings have, of course, an immensely complex relationship to space. And this is because of the kind of animals that we've turned into. All animals, I guess we can say, are agoraphobic, in the sense that all animals have a particular niche that they can occupy, and can really only occupy. So, you know, pretty much every animal has a particular space that it is identical with. Human beings, although we are limited to what you know, to the spaces we can inhabit, notably by temperature. We can only tolerate a pretty narrow range of temperatures. But we can live anywhere because we carry our niche with us. Mm. And the way we do that is architecture, you know, in the broader sense. So we, as it were, carry architecture around with us as transplantable ways of being at home. And it seems to me that architecture, far from being a way of grounding us and having to do with grounding, is actually has to do with our mobility. That's why I'm interested in the fact that this word dwelling originally means a kind of deflection or displacement, because I think architecture is human beings' ways of being and staying on the move, a kind of fundamental topophobia, you can call it.
Well, I would think architects are more keyed in than others in terms of that kind of uncomfortable abiding. If you think of the architects, you know, they're the ones who are always kind of questioning the spaces they're in, or indeed the homes they dwell in. They're always fiddling with, this wall will go, or I'll change this room, or we'll add a mezzanine. That there's never a real moment of calm dwelling for the architect. An architect, by definition, is always agitated about the space they might call home, whether they're in their home or on the go. You've mentioned agoraphobia, fear of open spaces. And I'm a touch claustrophobic, sort of inverse of that fear. And I wonder if, in fact, most architects aren't somewhat claustrophobic, that professional fraternity comes from a collective desire to make more space, enclose more air, in an effort to stave off claustrophobia, which is typified by a fear of what we might say is a fear of running out of air if we get into a lift. An elevator, we have that notion as claustrophobics that we'll run out of this precious thing, air. Suddenly air is foregrounded in those instances where architecture or built environment becomes particularly snug. Architects have this relationship, I'm saying claustrophobic, but maybe it's not as simple as that. You've actually introduced two special terms, spatiopedal versus spatiofugal, is that right?
Mm.
Could we sort of unpack those terms and maybe relate it to the sense of claustrophobia?
Yes. Well, what I meant to signify by these terms, I think is something quite simple. The spatiofugal would be space that is made from the inside out. And an example of that would be what Gaston Bachelard calls the burrowing instinct. And, you know, it's what we all do when we get into bed and we make a space by kind of rolling round in it. I don't know whether a dog gets into its basket and does that. But human beings, you know, burrow in lots and lots of different ways when you kind of tread out a path. That's a kind of burrowing. You know, it's a space that is not made for an action, it's made by an action. And so it's a sort of erosion track. Now, you know, that's rather unpredictable. It also takes a lot of time. It's quite wasteful. But once established, it's inherently very conservative. You know, people don't, on the whole, tend to build roads in new places. Mm-hmm. It's just so too much work to start a new road in a completely new way. So most roads, you know, in a country like the UK are where they've always been, you know, which is sometimes convenient, sometimes not. Spatiofugal. Spatiopetal space, I've suggested, would be space made from the outside in. And that's what's going on, I think, whenever you design a space, whenever you have a project, as we call it. I mean, in some essays I've suggested that there's a kind of movement of lassoing space, a kind of marking out from a position held to be outside that space of the position. Now, you know, it seems to me that more and more and more and more we've developed the spatiopetal, ways of being outside space rather than working within it. It isn't that one is better or worse, and in a certain sense both are always necessary. But I do think that the spatiopetal, as we design more and more and more, is perhaps becoming dominant.
I wonder if we could rehearse some of the terms, more nuanced terms, about air, because I've been using air as an umbrella term for lots of things, but one of the ways you discuss air is to actually tease out more specific elements that we think of when we think of air. Things like odor, things that aren't just a kind of neutral Cartesian sense of air, but things that are specific in location. One thinks of odor, one thinks of sound as well.
Yes.
But this notion, you have a beautiful way of sort of talking about air in all its formations. So these words like eddies, right, are very evocative, and they're more specific. And I think that term air, like space, is such a generic term that it's really useful to have some of these sort of subset words at hand.
This is the interest of the air for me, that it's fundamentally negative and positive at once. Everyone knows that the air isn't thin air. We have this expression, thin air. Mm. Shakespeare uses it first of all in English. I suspect that few people before Shakespeare would have thought of the air as thin in any way. I mean, you know, they might have thought of the air as populated with spirits and stinks and all kinds of agencies and entities that were on the move and were unpredictable and powerful. We increasingly, I think, have generated a notion of the air as just space in the sense of emptiness, space within which other things can happen. And I think that may be related to this centripetal impulse, as it were, to imagine yourself outside space and then kind of ordering that space from the outside in rather than from the inside out. For two or three centuries, we've begun to get some understanding of what this thing, the air as a substance, as opposed to just a dimension, consists of. And it's very extraordinary. It is really one of the newest of the sciences, atmospheric science. Oxygen wasn't discovered until the end of the 18th century. Something like oxygen was suspected, but really not kind of known about. So it's really very, very new, this sense that air is stuff, is substance. It has weight. It has elasticity. It has properties. And, of course, it's finite.
Mm-hmm.
That finitizing of the air, it seems to me, is part of our radically new moment because of climate change, because of the fact that we can, as it were, you know, we recognize that what we do may very well change the composition of this stuff that previously had just been, as it were, the realm of the given, the absolute, the eternal, and the infinite. So I think that all of those things that relate to the mutability of the air, rather than to the air as it were, a kind of given emptiness, they're the things that we probably should become more attuned to. So things like the fact that the air is the bearer of sound, which means that you know, air becomes a kind of temporal thing rather than a spatial thing. You know, the air is never still, it's never just given, because it's agitated, among other things, by sound. But it's not, you know, that sound is never continuous. It's always, you know, it's a series of events of fluctuating states. It's a weather.
Mm.
It's a weather. And now we have, I think, to get back that sense of air as fluctuating weather. So it's sound, it's odour, another of the things that, you know, comes and goes. Odour is in fact the most temporal not of the senses, but of what affects the senses. You know, smell is the most easily exhausted of the senses. If you want to stop smelling a nasty smell, you can either block your nose or breathe deeply. They both
right.
work. The smell goes away. You know, we can't. You know, so smell and sound are really like that in being carried on the air, but never being uniform.
We might end today by noting that just now in Hyde Park, outside the Serpentine Gallery, Rem Koolhaas has seen his tea pavilion take shape. This is part of a series of temporary tea pavilions architects have been asked to design near the gallery. What's interesting about Rem Koolhaas's project is the principal materials for the building are steel and helium. The roof of the tea pavilion is meant to float, to hover, be buoyant, quite literally be a kind of castle in the sky again. On a cold day, that balloon roof sits very snugly on the cylindrical wall. On a beautiful day, that balloon rises into the air, allowing in natural light and, of course, sound from the park. If we think of that notion of castle in the air, which is might be something Rem is playing with, you say buildings are largely imaginary. All buildings are in part castles in the air. We live them, their lives and deaths, in imagination, even as buildings are part of the way in which the cultural imagination functions and forms itself. I think of teaching architecture, and I think of our students, as being involved in 3 and 4 and 5 years' worth of operations to do with the castle in the sky, the imaginary architecture of academic study, of studio work. Could it not be said that students are engaged in designing castles in the air, so to speak, but that indeed architecture school itself, for good or ill, is kind of an airy configuration, a kind of warehouse of cultural imagination. And I don't know how to bring it back particularly to Rem, but there is something quite shocking about a pavilion in the series that almost doesn't exist, that might float away, might be drifting down the river.
Yes, well, I think that what might be happening here is that architects are becoming interested in the relationship between the ideal and the real. They've always, of course, been interested in that, but in the mode of projection, that's to say, you know, the ideal is just the real separated in time. Your idea of something is what it will turn out to be, you hope, or turn out not to be. Now, increasingly, architects are also interested in what happens to the things that they bring about, really, so to speak, in the world, after they brought them about. And I think the technological capacity that we have now to create buildings that are much more supplely responsive to the uses that people make of them, that, as it were, can be spatiopetal to begin with, but then become spatiofugal. They can change their shape as a result of the particular uses that are made of them. That, in a way, is starting with an idea, having an intermediary stage of the real, and then a new idea comes about. It's almost though the idea comes last for the building, and or at least there's a kind of circuit or an alternation of the ideal and the real. Maybe something like that is what is going on. This isn't anything new. This is, in fact, the way that it's always been for architects and designers and makers and builders of anything, whether they are novels or plays or buildings. The fact that we live our lives so literally in the medium of air, that we live our lives in the exchanges that take place, you know, not tangibly, not visibly, not permanently, but in the events of our interrelationships, mean that, I suppose, in a way, that the air becomes the favoured location for those interchanges between the real and the ideal.
It's a beautiful place to stop, actually. So I have to thank you, Stephen Connor, for joining us this afternoon, and thanks for participating in Architecture on Air, if not of air. Thanks very much. Catch them.
You've been listening to Architecture on Air. Our technical director is Matt Parker, and our series assistant is Jason Slutinsky. The music included in this program, Castles in the Air by the French Impressionists, is used by kind permission of LTM Records.